The word of the last episode was acceptance. And it seems to be that acceptance is turning into a bit of a theme around this podcast. So welcome to another episode of the Fuck It Moments podcast. Sometimes I say this idea around the changes that happen on our life, these crossroads that we find ourselves, can come through choice or circumstance. And when they come through circumstance, that word acceptance kind of lingers. There's that resistance that's within us where we kind of hope that things might be slightly different than they really are. And that was definitely something that the guest on today's podcast really wrestled with for quite some number of years. There are some phrases that I think are particularly apt around the journey that Sheridan's been on, and also imagine some of you, and also phrases that I feel have kind of gone around my head again and again and again as I face some of my crossroads over the last couple of years. So here's a few quotes to kind of hit you around the head with. Take a notepad if need be, they might resonate with you. So one of which is that this idea of whatever happens, I'll handle it. And letting go of our fear and just kind of seeing what will happen, taking that first step forwards and just knowing that you have all the things that you need to go and work it out. And sometimes you don't know the answers, but just by taking that first step and then the next step and the next step, you kind of just learn to work the answers out. No one knows the answers to, you know, everything in life straight away. You find people come to you, situations come to you that kind of just give you the answers. The hardest bit is making a decision, having a dream in the first place. So kind of stating that and then deciding, well, whatever happens, I'll handle it. The other is this phrase around acceptance. And one of the books that I'd read a number of years ago was a Tao Te Ching. And Taoism is something that I looked into when I traveled through China. And just looking at some of the books from this particular following, religion, however you describe it, really, they're kind of like short poems, but they have deeper meanings. And one of the phrases that I kind of just opened by pure chance early this year was a particular chapter which talked about water. And it had this concept that water gives itself without protest. And when I stopped and thought about that, I thought that was really apt. Water gives itself to everything without protest. And, you know, there's no kind of resistance there. Sometimes these things happen. Things don't go our way. And why do we fight with that? And I'm not saying kind of just to lie down and let everyone walk over you, but there was something in that to stop fighting all the time and stop fearing and stop resisting what actually is the reality of whatever situation we're grappling with. I thought that was kind of apt. And then another phrase that came to me is when we are kind of shedding our skin, you know, we're like chameleons, becoming something and someone else. And we're not quite who we used to be, but we're not quite who we want to be yet. We're in that middle murky stage. Then this particular phrase came to me, I can't even remember where I read it, but it's kind of lingered around when I've been doing my daily journaling. And the phrase is, let go of who you were and become who you are. And I think that phrase is so apt when you hear the story of Sheridan. Sheridan is someone who professionally is known as a radio presenter. He's known now as an author, a writer, a public speaker. He's even a former funk DJ, which I didn't know. That's not on his website. A little cheeky fact that he gives away at the start of this interview you'll hear in the moment. But Sheridan's been on a huge personal journey, him and his wife. Where their decision to have children didn't quite go to plan. In fact, that's probably putting it politely. He had a real struggle with this. and what's come out of this, and by the way that I ended up meeting Sheridan, was he was speaking at a fertility festival, and he was on stage talking about he and his wife's journey, which I won't go into too much detail because he can explain it much better than I can. But Sheridan is putting his head above the parapet, and he wants to give reassurance to guys, not just women, but guys who are struggling with male infertility. And this is no mean feat. He's going against so many different stereotypes that guys don't cry, guys don't talk about problems, guys don't need help. There's just so many different things. And we kind of ended up getting quite deep, and we got really personal in this conversation. And as someone who works in the broadcasting industry, I know how difficult that is for a presenter to truly open their heart and speak so openly and vulnerably. And I think when you hear how honest and open Sheridan is, then you'll see that he's a really cool guy, and he's making waves. And from the moment that I saw him standing on stage, that very first time that I met Sheridan, right to us having this conversation at his home over a cup of tea, I think that you can see that there's something very special and unique about Sheridan, and his bravery should absolutely be commended. So whether you are on that personal journey of going through different fertility things, and that's why you've clicked on this, or you're just someone who is curious about this kind of thing that some of us have within us to just find a way to muddy through when life isn't always given to us A to B to C to D. It ends up being a bit more like A, L, J, R, has happened with me and Sheridan. And somehow it just kind of works out. This is a story of hope. It's a story of happiness, but it has a muddy bit in the middle. And the obvious place for us to start was where his journey began, which was on the other side of the world.
Brisbane, in those days, probably still to a good degree now, very much a blokey place to be a guy. So I've realised in later years that I never quite fit into the masculine image of a Brisbane bloke. Funnily enough that I bring that up, you know, as the first thing that I say to you, but I think later on that really became quite a thing that I discovered. And so you're growing up in Brisbane. I've got English parents. I've got an English accent, even though I was born in Brisbane. So I'm beaten up in the schoolyard for being a pommy, even though I was actually born in Australia. So that is part of the shaping of who I later became. I really wanted to become a DJ in nightclubs. And so in my later teens, I actually started going to DJ competitions, DMCs, they were called, actually originated here in the UK. And I started to get some experience, and I started to win some of those competitions, come runner-up at least anyway, runner-up in Queensland. And yet it didn't really somehow fill a space inside. I started to see the success, and I started to get my name on posters and things by the time I was 18, 19. And it wasn't filling the void inside. A little while after that, I became a Christian. That was a major turning point for my life. I then went to Bible college, of all places, to go and actually study theology. Wasn't expecting that. During that time, I felt a call to go into radio. Again, wasn't on the, you know, DJs never, radio, nightclub DJs never want to do radio because they want to mix and cut and scratch. They don't want to talk. But ended up then going into radio. Marin and I got married in 1996. Then I went from Brisbane, then we went over to Perth for me to do a morning show over at a station in Perth, and then in the year 2006 moved over to Sydney to start a national talkback show, and then in 2011 moved here, and along the way there's been some books and things like that. So is that a good beginning to your question?
what have been the kind of the most enjoyable moments? That's an epic journey, isn't it? Mm. The DJ that became the talk show host, hilarious in itself, isn't it?
Very much.
What have been the moments in your life would have kind of really, they make your heart smile thinking back to perhaps some of the times in Australia?
Would you believe, only a few years ago, I was flicking through YouTube, and I don't know how I came across it, but I came across a video of my 17-year-old self. My name wasn't attached to the video.
Yeah.
And there I was. And it was a video from one of these DMC competitions back in 1989.
Were you any good?
I was not bad. I was not bad. I was actually looking, gosh, you actually had some skills, man. You had just skills. That was a very special moment because I remember that on the one hand, I was still, 17 years old and I was still kind of lost and trying to find my way in the world. But I remember that this was the first time that I got in front of several hundred people in a big nightclub called Transformers, it was called, this huge nightclub, multi-level thing. And here I am in front of them, all of them doing this, DJing and stuff. I remember that was just such a big thing for little introverted Sheridan, who for the first 12 years of my life, I was an only child. So I was really used to my own company. And so going out and doing something like that in front of other people, that was a special moment. That was a really special moment. Launching the national show in 2006 was a very, very special moment. It had been a 10-year dream come true. I had originally had this dream for this particular kind of show in 1995. I remember sitting by the Brisbane River dreaming of this show. And it would take 10 years of going to Perth and then, later on to Sydney and everything to actually get it working. And I remember the night that, we went to air, and I remember driving home and slamming my hands against the steering wheel going, yes, yes, yes.
What were you doing then? What was the concept of this show?
It was a talk show that explored life, faith and culture. And we started networked between two city stations, Sydney and Melbourne, and then it moved to about 8 or 9 different cities. It was a show that just explored the deeper things of life, came from a Christian perspective, but was open to people of all ideas, worldviews, theologies, spiritualities, whatever. So every night was fascinating because we'd have a Muslim call in. We would have a Hindu priest call in one night, Scientologists call in. We would have Alain de Botton and atheists like that who would come on and onto the show, would have the now current Prime Minister of Australia call in just off his own bat. So we had an amazing time like that. So I got to host that show for 5 years. So it was a great dream come true. That was a real highlight.
Yeah. A key point for you was the decision to leave Australia. And that kind of came about through a whole windy road of different things that happened to you. How do you want to explain how you kind of got to that point?
The radio show was called Open House, and it was a 10-year dream that got fulfilled, but funnily enough, almost at the same kind of parallel time, there was another 10-year dream that we were pursuing, and that was having a family. And that was a dream that was much harder to see fulfilled. So we started in the year 2000, making that decision like so many couples do, maybe now's the time. And, within 9 months, thought that maybe we should go and get some tests done. The tests revealed there was a problem on my side and that, without some sort of technological assistance or divine miracle, we were going to be struggling to get our dreamt of child. And that began 10 years, Claire, of trying so many different things. We tried special diets. We tried special supplements. At one stage, our dining room table was full of little pills and potions and things, primarily for me, but for both of us. We tried chiropractic, which to this day, I do not know why we tried chiropractic to have children. We tried our first round of IVF in 2006, and it didn't work. Then we looked into adoption. We started looking at overseas adoption. We thought maybe a child from the Philippines would be good, but then it looked very clear that that program was going to close very soon. So we looked locally, actually, the social worker who was interviewing us to see whether we were suitable people to look after somebody else's biological child, she actually said to us, you know, look, if you switch to local adoption, so many people are going overseas that actually, you know, there's more children available locally. So we switched locally and we went through the 8 months of almost torturous assessment, you know, the kinds of questions that they ask, really prying into your life and everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, suitably so. They want to work out whether you're a stable couple that can bring a already most likely traumatized child into their home. But that was tough. I remember the night of the final assessment interview, and this really lovely lady, she got up and she went to the front door and she was about to let herself out. And she said, look, I know I shouldn't say this. I know that as a social worker, I should keep my feelings to myself. But I'm going to say this anyway. You're a very attractive couple. I don't think it's going to take long before you're placed with a child. Just wait for the phone call. And so we waited for the phone call.
Wow. And talk about the hope as well in that moment.
Absolutely. We waited for the phone call because we had hope. And 1 week passed and 2 weeks and 1 month and 2 months and 6 months and 9 months, no phone call. And that ultimately led to nearly 2 years of waiting for the phone call and it not happening. There's a proverb in the Jewish and Christian scriptures that says, hope deferred makes the heart sick. And we learnt that, and particularly Meryn, my wife, really learnt that, is that hope can be a burden. And when you're waiting every day for the phone call to come and it doesn't come, or if it's just every 28 days and you're waiting for the period to be missed, or whether it's the latest blood test from the IVF or whatever, you know, it's hard. And by that stage, she felt like her very being was being picked apart. And so she said, look, can we try IVF again? We discovered then that we had to let go of the adoption process to try IVF. We couldn't do both together.
Yeah.
Good reasons for that, but it was difficult. We'd almost invested 3 years in this. So we made the decision, okay, we'll let go of that and we'll go and do as many rounds of IVF as it would take.
Yeah.
And by December of 2010, 10 years after that original conversation to start our family, we had one embryo left of our last round of IVF and we decided this is it. We're exhausted. We're done. If this embryo doesn't result in a viable pregnancy, then we're just going to move on with our lives. And, we got a phone call on the last couple of weeks of December saying to Meryn, it's looking good. All your hormone levels are exactly where we'd expect them to be for a pregnancy. And we told our parents and we told our close friends and there was jubilation in the streets. And then on Christmas Eve of 2010, we had the same nurse call up from the IVF clinic and she said, I'm so sorry, but you're not pregnant. And with that, Meryn put the phone down, walked into our room, curled up in a fetal position on our bed, and that was it. That's where the dream ended.
Yeah.
That's a long way to tell you that then Meryn needed a consolation prize, just something. And the only thing that she'd ever wanted to do apart from become a mum was to live and work overseas. So later on down the track, a few months, she was offered a job at Oxford University, and we saw that as a good consolation prize.
Yeah.
And we came here to the UK and yeah. Here we are.
Let's just go back a couple of steps because there's two things there, isn't there? I'm intrigued to know quite often what I find from talking to people who've been through the IVF procedure that it can often be something that people do behind closed doors. It is not often talked about. And because of that fear of the stigma, of the fact that it might not work out, how much did the people who were close to you, but also those kind of perhaps colleagues and things, how much did they know about what you were going through?
Good question. It's not something that you want to broadcast because it's such a difficult road. And actually sometimes you don't want to have people ask you how you're going and how did the round go. Other times that's all you want. Is somebody to ask you how you're going and how did the round of IVF go? They can't win. It's very hard to know who to talk to about it. Sometimes people come out with the silliest, stupidest things. If you just relax, then of course, you know, it'll be right. And, you know, well, I'm sure it'll all happen for you. And, you know, try this remedy. And, oh, I've got a little newspaper cutting for you. You know, this little thing, this special remedy that comes from, you know, Nicaragua, this will help. You know, so it's a hard thing. You have to choose some really, just a few really close people that you know will just listen, and then we'll check in with you from time to time and see how you're going. I can't think of any colleagues I told. I think I told my producer at one stage, and so that just kind of to let her know why I had to, you know, duck out on a Friday afternoon to for us to go and do the next thing, whatever it was needed in the journey that we were doing then. I think, you know, doing a course in looking after an adopted child or something. Parents knew, close friends knew, and the same thing with adoption. Funnily enough, adoption can raise different questions for people. So for our parents, for instance, it was interesting that we didn't get much response from our parents when it came to talking about adoption. There are so many things actually that need to be explored with having an adopted child come into your family, ought to do with identity and things. And actually it's good to send parents and other family members books about that. It was the one thing that we didn't get any feedback on, which was interesting. So the conversations were difficult. I remember one day walking past, I was down walking down the street and walking past a group of people that were sitting outside of a pub having lunch. And I noticed, I knew one of the guys there, and I said hello to him, and he said hello, and before I knew it, I was being invited to sit down at this table and have lunch with them. And just, I don't know how it happened, but I ended up getting talking to the guy next to me about IVF. And he said, well, my wife and I have been through two rounds of, we've had two children through IVF, so I know a little bit about this experience, you know, would you like to talk further? And I remember just utter relief there's somebody else who knows what it's like, because nobody that I did speak to knew anything about it. And that's why they were quite, it was so easy to come up with simplistic comments and answers.
The other thing, I suppose, is that fertility is something that is considered a woman's issue. And that men are kind of, you do your thing and then you know, your job's done. Tick. You've completed your mission in life.
Oh, what glory it is to be a man.
Your legacy continues, whatever the phrase may be. So, you know, I guess it's kind of a more difficult question to ask, really, but how did that impact you and your idea of masculinity and I guess also your, how that made you feel towards the fact that this is something that your wife, who you really love, really wants, and like you're a main cause to this.
I'm the reason why she can't have what she desperately wants. That was the biggest source of pain for me personally.
Yeah.
Particularly towards the end, when we're towards the end of that 10 years. And, you know, when IVF was happening, I was holding a sobbing wife every second night. That was the hardest bit. I'm the cause of this. The question about masculinity was a really interesting one for me. And it goes back to being this strange kid in Brisbane who didn't quite fit in to the blokey culture of Brisbane, being a Brisbane bloke, which is all about beer and football. And I never fit into that. So funnily enough, that actually, in a sense, shielded me a bit from having my masculinity really suddenly cut, because I never felt like an Aussie bloke anyway. And so when people say, how do you get up as a bloke and talk about these things? I can't talk to my mates about this. And they'll, you know, I'll be talking at a conference and they'll pull me around, you know, around the corner where nobody else can see and say, hey, mate, that's my problem too. How can you get up on the stage and talk about that? And I say, well, it didn't hit me to the same degree because I never felt like an Aussie bloke.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit of a mercy, I think. But the not being able to fulfill my wife's dreams was really, really big. And, yeah, that turned inwards. There was a sense in which, you know, some people kind of shake their fist at heaven and say, you know, why isn't heaven helping me? Other people point inwards and say, you're the problem. Well, my wife did the first and I did the second. Yeah. That's how it worked for us.
This may be a difficult question for you to answer, but I think that people might be thinking it, so I'm going to be brave and ask it. Did you ever have the conversation with your wife to say, look, if you want children and it'd be easy for you to go find somebody else, you know, that could be an option? Was that conversation ever had?
So kind of to divorce and so she's able to move on?
Divorce or yeah.
Or do you mean donor sperm?
I guess there are so many different options. Mm. It's not quite kind of a see you later off with the next guy. There are many different options of which you explored. So, but yeah, I guess it's difficult knowing when that is kind of within you. Is there somebody else that can fulfill? And sometimes is it best to let go of somebody to have their dream? There's so many different things. This isn't a Disney story. This is real life.
It is. That's right. We were sitting in an IVF counsellor's office one day, and the IVF counsellor said to us, well, you know that IVF can bring a lot of pressure onto a marriage, a lot of pressure onto a couple. And we thought that she meant the drugs, because the drugs that the woman has to take can kind of make her incredibly fertile and then almost plunge her into like an artificial menopause, you know, so that can do all sorts of things with your emotions. And she said, well, I'm not talking about that. I'm actually talking about the decision-making. Talking about when you don't agree about how many rounds of IVF to do, when to call it quits, those kinds of things. And Marin said to her, Sheridan and I have already decided that if having a child and our pursuit of having a child gets in the way of our marriage, then we call an end to the pursuit of the child. We won't let it affect our marriage.
Wow.
And, you know, with that, the counsellor actually slumped in her chair and she said, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because just yesterday a couple sat in exactly the same chairs you're in now, and the woman said to me in front of her husband, if this doesn't work, if we don't have a child, this marriage is over.
Wow.
So that's your answer. We had already made the commitment that our marriage was steadfast. It was the solid thing that wasn't going to be budged or changed or detrimentally affected. And if it did start to become detrimentally affected by this, well, then we would call the other journey off. We would never kind of call it quits on the marriage or anything like that, or allow it to affect. And I'm really grateful that we'd made that decision, because we, as the years went on, we realized actually just what that counselor meant. Often we were not on the same page. I would have ended the journey 5 years earlier easily. Donor sperm, we never really talked about. It was never really something that kind of was an option for us. And I think there was almost that sense of, I'm not too sure we really want to bring a third party into this. But of course, that's exactly what you're doing with adoption, which we were looking at. So, you know, I've talked to other people since, and I can see that there are different ways to look at that. But no, we didn't really explore that.
Yeah. It feels like in this situation, there are so many different options, but you have to follow your individual path, don't you? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it can be about timing. And I mean, how do you kind of give support or hope to people who might be going through that listening right now, either men or women? Because you've gone on to write so many books about this particular, you know, topic that you guys kind of went through. What kind of words do you say so that, I guess, not even people who are going through it, but family members or friends who know people who are going through, what kind of things should we be saying to support those people? It's hard to find the right words, but which words work for you?
Well, to the couple themselves, I would be really cautious about giving too many words, actually. I would just be sitting alongside them and just saying, you know what, in this particular situation, I do know a little bit about what you're going through, and I know the tension and the stress and the devastation, you know, every month that hope is dashed again, and that really can pick your very soul apart. So I'd explore with them, you know, where they're up to and where they're... I was just talking to a guy just the other day. He said, I've never talked to anybody about this. And he said, look, can I please Skype you? And so we made a time to Skype. And I said, I haven't told anybody about this. I can't find anybody who I want to talk to about it. I feel ashamed about it. And therein unraveled about 90 minutes of just listening to where he and his wife is at. And I didn't have any answers for them, because they've got to make some big decisions as to whether they try again or whether they don't. It's just a case of, I'm going to support you as much as I can with whatever decision you make. I will tell them, though, that in the back of their mind, there is this deep fear that that if this doesn't work, our lives are over. I think there is that in the back of the mind, and I can say, look, Merrin and I are here to let you know that even if the worst happens and you don't get this dreamt of child, actually it won't be the end of your life. In fact, you can live a very good life. You can actually find that you can have a good, strong marriage, and you can have great quality friendships with other people, as difficult as that can be sometimes when they have kids. You can actually see your pain redeemed, recycled into great help for other people. There is still identity and purpose for you, even if you don't have children. That's what I'd tell to the couple themselves.
And that kind of ties in quite nicely to one of the titles of one of your many books that you've gone on to write since, The Making of Us. I mean, let's kind of move to the next chapter where you kind of close that book, I suppose, and you open a new one. It's like that excitement of start of a season at school, a new year, school year, where you get a blank
book.
Journal and you think, right, what am I going to write in it this year?
Yes.
And that, I guess, was what life was a bit like when you made that decision to come over to Oxford. And there were so many different things that you ended up doing, didn't you? Pilgrimages and writing books. So in essence, this was a huge fuck it moment for both you and your wife. But you were kind of almost having different kind of new chapters, but doing it alongside each other. What kind of, how did you kind of embrace that fuck it moment of moving to the UK? Because essentially you were walking away from a dream job, this talk show, which you just spoke so passionately about. That meant for you that you had to walk away from that and think, what do I do next? How did you go about make, you know, a new life for you and a new career, I suppose?
Well, therein lies kind of the story of, yes,
you're still doing
two
that.
Of those books. And very much I think I have been. So, yeah, I mean, Resurrection Year is the book that tells our story. And Resurrection Year is our first 12 months of coming to the UK and starting again. And then this latest one, The Making of Us, subtitled Who We Can Become When Life Doesn't Go As Planned, huh? You get where we're going with this, is kind of picking up about 5 years later or so. So it was a great move for Merrin to come to the UK. Merrin has jumped into the best place for her in the world, quite literally. So her field is in medical statistics, and then she's really kind of honed a little niche out for herself in vaccinology. And Oxford University is the leading place in the world to be doing that. So she just jumped into the best place possible. And she has just gone from strength to strength to strength. She's doing stuff with the World Health Organization, and she's doing multi-country projects on malaria and typhoid. And, you know, it's been absolutely astounding. I found it a more difficult move. I really missed that radio show. And I can say, actually now, 7 years going on, 8 years later, I still miss it. I still miss being on air. I still miss being in your chair,
yeah.
You know, when you're actually doing the hosting. Particularly in the first 2 years, and I would say probably it took about 5 years or so of trying to answer these two questions. What I found myself wrestling with again, which I didn't expect, was asking those two big questions. Who am I and what am I doing here? Identity and purpose. Now, I had answered those questions some years ago, and I had 15, 20 years of knowing who I was. I was a writer, speaker, broadcaster. And what was I to do? I was to do the radio show, I was to do books, and I was to kind of communicate things. But then when I came over here, well, let's look at that. The writing, I went and approached some publishers about a book project that I had and I was working on. They all turned me down because I wasn't known over here. One actually said, come back to us when you're famous. Right. I'll sort that out by next Thursday. Come back to you then. So that was closing. Speaking, nobody was asking me to speak at their conferences. Again, I wasn't known. Broadcasting, BBC local radio here in Oxford wasn't returning my phone calls, you know. And so I said, well, who are you now? If this doesn't open up for you, writing, speaking, broadcasting, well, who are you? And I had to go on a search for something deeper. And The Making of Us, in many ways, is kind of me going on that journey. It's set in a pilgrimage that only lasted 8 days, but of course that being the metaphor for our lives. In fact, all of our lives are pilgrimages. They're kind of windy trails going to an end destination, and there's all sorts of things for us to learn and ways for us to change along that path. But I discovered, you know what? I'm much bigger than all of my career identities. At this one moment, I'm a husband, and I'm a son, and I'm a brother, and I'm a friend. So our relational identities often get pushed aside in our culture because we focus so much on the career roles that we have. Mm. Actually, those are really precious. We've really neglected this whole idea of being a friend. I mean, that's a precious thing. You know, back in the day, I mean, Aristotle and the great thinkers and Solomon in scripture, you know, they always talk about friendship being one of the key aspects of life. We've minimized that. To be a good friend is a holy calling. That was a big thing, to recognize that my personality is part of my identity. And why do I like 80s funk? You know, why is it, you know, this particular window between 1982 and 1987? That was the key. Why is that? That's part of who I am. All of those things, my gifts and my talents, those are part of who I am. So it was looking at a bigger sense of who I was. And for me, as a committed Christian, it was really going deep into this idea. I'm a child of God. And that identity can't be taken away from me, whether through success or failure or death. Do I really believe that? Do I really rest in that and find my deepest sense of significance and warmth and embrace from God, who's my Father? So that was my journey into answering that question. And then the purpose then flows out of that.
That's also quite an interesting concept as well, because of the, you know, the Christian side. Because there can be some people who almost, when life doesn't go their way, they turn to prayer and hope that miracles will happen and things will change. And, you know, my phrase is stress is wanting things to be different than they are. And was there ever a time where you were actually really pissed off at God?
Yes, very much so.
Dude, I'm here doing all I can. I'm living the good life here. I'm doing all you're saying. And it still ain't working for me. Nice one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said before, our two primary responses, Marin's was to blame God and say, why aren't you coming through for us? And so her relationship with God went very cold for some years, she would say. I felt that God was too holy and pure and everything like that to go that far. And so I blamed myself. But there's no doubt there were times where it's just like, just heard of another Christian friend who prayed and they fell pregnant. Okay, well, we've been waiting a little bit longer than them, God. Mm-hmm. Why them and why not us? And then, of course, you bump up just against a horrible, evil world where one night we were sitting in the lounge room and watching the news and a story came on about a child that had been found on a conveyor belt at a rubbish tip. And it's just like, here we are waiting for one.
Wow.
And somebody else got them and did that to them? What kind of world is this? Now, the Christian faith actually has answers for that. It actually says this world is not the way it's supposed to be. It's not the way God intended it. And actually the whole life, death and resurrection of Jesus is all about renewing the life and the world as it should be. And so my calling as a Christian is actually to be part of his work of doing that. That doesn't mean, though, that I don't have my own moments just like Jesus on the cross saying, my God, where are you? Why have you forsaken me? Mm. And that's the most amazing thing I think about my faith is that all the words of doubt, all the questions that you have about when God doesn't come through for you in a particular moment, actually you find them in our very own scriptures. They are right throughout the Old Testament. They're on the very words of Jesus himself, the Son of God. And so this is actually a faith that embraces all that and somehow says, but still God is good in the midst of it and can bring great things out of it, which is what we have certainly experienced.
Mm. I'm not somebody who is Christian, but I consider myself fairly spiritual and I want good in the world and I want good for all people. You know, I look to live life by good values and
I can tell.
And care about people. But there's something that you kind of said about and a big part of the theme for Making of Us about life not always panning out the way that we want it to. When you're kind of going through this journey of discovery when you land in the UK and Marin's like soaring from strength to strength, how do you kind of decipher, right, one foot in front of the other? Which step is right? Which route is right? You know, how do you kind of go around and find those answers? Because I've definitely had many moments in my life. To be honest, most of my 20s, I just felt like there was a sense of, I was just lost. I was just bumbling around looking for short-term fixes. you know, plasters to kind of just paper over and just hope that it would all be okay in the end. And yeah, it'll work out. I'll find the man of my dreams. I'll have the home, the family that I always want, because that's what we should have. And, you know, the shoulds and mm-hmm. all these types of things. I'm intrigued to kind of, how did you go about kind of finding the right answers for you? Because they don't come so quickly, do they? And so easily.
No.
That's a bit of a journey in itself.
Funnily enough, I still do believe in prayer. I still do believe that God answers prayer. And I do believe that as I pray and that as I walk forward, then doors will open and doors will close. And so that's what I did do. And I also had a lot of coffees with people. So I actually had a lot of time of just sitting down with people here in the UK and just saying, tell me about this. Tell me about that aspect. I met with radio stations. I met with editors of magazines. Some of those doors didn't open. Some of them a year later did. Those kinds of things. So I just kept on, as you said, step.
Well, my mom calls it chihuahua steps.
Oh, right.
She's got this thing that you shouldn't be taking dinosaur steps because they're extinct. But if you take chihuahua steps, then you're going to get there bit by bit.
They're still here.
So you were doing your chihuahua steps.
I was, very much so. And it's really funny because the first book, Resurrection Year, well, the first book I wrote when I was here about our experience, wasn't even on my radar to do. It was a guy named Adrian Plass, who's quite a well-known writer, who said to me, you should be writing your story into a book. And I hadn't even thought about doing it. I was working on another book completely different, and it was kind of part of my old life in many ways. And then when I sat down and started to write our story, it seemed to flow. It was rejected by UK publishers, and then it was picked up by a US publisher who looked beyond the platform thing, the fact that I wasn't well known, and looked at the story and said, we wanted to publish this. God bless the Americans. So that was one of those things where also listening to other people's input into your life as well and saying, you know what, I'm seeing something here that maybe you're not seeing. So I think that was important. But also still pursuing that little dream, you know, that in the end I couldn't get away from the fact that I still had to write and I still had to speak and I still had to communicate in some kind of way. It turned out that it wasn't going to be hosting a show, but what's turned out beautifully is the fact that now I get to sit on this side of the desk and actually get to give my own content, which of course is much harder when you're actually in the host chair. Mm. So that slowly started to open up too. So that combination of just praying, knocking on some doors, hustling, listening to people, having a lot of conversations, networking, and pursuing the little dream that you would like to pursue, and it may take years. But it certainly took me a few years before I could actually answer those questions, who am I and what am I doing here, afresh.
When you started to talk about your story, and you say about sitting on the other side of the desk, what kind of response did you get? And I guess what kind of response were you expecting as well?
Well, writing the book it required some decisions to be made. How honest are we going to get about just how disappointed we were in God, as you asked before?
And interesting that you say we as well. So I guess
yes,
there had to be some big conversations about this is impacting us and family as well.
Oh, very much so. So when Adrian suggested to me to write our story into a book, I thought, well, Meryn's never going to want to do that. I've been the public one. She's the quiet one, you know, working behind the scenes. But she kind of went away and thought about it, and she said, I think you are supposed to do this. And so I had her permission to do it. I made sure that she had first eyes on every chapter that I wrote to make sure she was happy with it. So I may have written the book, but it was our story. But a decision had to be made. Well, how honest are we going to get? Are we really going to put it all out there, the great disappointment and the grief that you go through? Without having a death, you know, it's these little deaths that happen every month. Are we really going to show how emotionally racking that was? We decided that we're not going to serve our readers well unless we actually did do that. So I remember one family member who read through the manuscript who said, just way too personal. You've shared way too much. It's way too in-depth about your emotions and everything like that. And others for whom it was, oh my goodness, I didn't realize to the depth in which you felt going through this journey. And of course, that one element, making that decision to go and be as raw and honest and vulnerable as we possibly could, has been the thing that has resonated with so many people. And Resurrection Year in particular has connected with people far beyond infertility. It's people that haven't been able to find Mr. and Mrs. Right, or they've lost a child, or they've lost their marriage, or they've lost the career, or whatever. And so that was a key thing. But you're absolutely right. You know, there was more people involved than just simply me writing that. So I wasn't sure how it was going to be received. It turned out to be received really, really well. And The Making of Us is not the same degree of emotional depth because, you know, we could never go through something like that again unless we were to have a child and lose it, I think would be that kind of level of disappointment and despondency. But also trying to be really honest and actually say, sometimes this is really difficult and I'm not going to give you cliches or platitudes in this book. I am not. And this is why The Making of Us took 4 years to write, because I wanted to make sure I could come up with some answers to those two big questions without resorting to cliches.
Let's talk about the word home, because I think that this may be something that you and I share in common in how do we define home. And even only the other day, I was driving down the motorway and Google Maps, I pressed the word home. It said, just take me home. And then you just let it navigate you. And what I had failed to realise is that I had set my home to be where I live now in Manchester. But actually, I was driving to Coventry to see my mum. And so in my head, I thought, well, I'm going home, press home. And so the sat-nav was telling me, you're going the wrong way, you're going the wrong way. Turn around, U-turn. And it took me a while to figure out what I'd done. But as someone who's lived in, I'm about to move into my 18th home in 18 years and have lived in different countries and travelled the world, you know, similar to you, I do find that word home an interesting one, because the connotations around home of it's a place where your family is, a physical building, a place where it carries all these memories and things. And sometimes when you, particularly as an adult, and you have to move and start again to recreate your home and start with a blank canvas, which can be both exciting but also quite daunting. And to make friends as an adult, I think, is one of the most difficult things. As someone who's moved cities many times, it is so difficult. What does the word home mean to you as someone who's from Brisbane, who's lived in Perth, Sydney, and now Oxford, and all the other places in between? You know, where do you consider home, and what does that word mean to you?
Yeah, well, I talk about that in The Making of Us at one stage, because I go back to Brisbane and I'm sitting in this place called Kangaroo Point, which is this beautiful cliff that overlooks pretty much the city. So you can look down there. And I remember I'm sitting there looking at all these key moments that happened in my life. So I look down to the left and there's Southbank Park, where Merrin and I had our first date. If I could kind of look in amongst some of the streets of the big city that's right in front of me, I could remember and see the restaurant where we went on the night that I proposed. Up around the corner and following the Brisbane River that's snaking through the city, if I followed that just around the corner to the left, is the first radio station I worked at. A little bit further on, my first home out of my home, you know, my first rented flat. Around to the right is where my dad used to drive me to my first job in the morning. A whole bunch of these things that happened, you know, which are so formative for me, and yet Brisbane had never felt like home.
Wow.
I'd spent 26 years of my life there. I was born there, but Brisbane had just never felt like home. Perth, we had 6.5 good years over in Perth. It was good, but it wasn't really home. Then we got to Sydney, and it's just like, oh, I like this. Oh, this is good. This feels like home. I've thought about that often, and I think I've brought it down to the fact that home is where you can be you. You can be who you are, but it's also where you can become who you're meant to be. And I think Sydney somehow offered both of those senses for me. I didn't have to be the football, beer-drinking guy that Brisbane wanted me to be, or at least I perceived Brisbane wanted me to be. Mm. I could have conversations with people. I could go to the art galleries in Sydney. I could have conversations about philosophy and theology with people and they wouldn't, you know, roll their eyes and go, what are you on, mate? Here's a Forex instead. That was great. I could be who I was. But also Sydney was that big enough place that actually it could kind of expand me to become the person I was meant to be. It was not an easy place to live. It actually forced me to be bigger than who I was. And so I think that's my definition of home. It's where you can be who you are, but become who you're meant to be.
Do you think some of that is to do with timing as well? That when you're a little bit older, you're a little bit more comfortable with who you are and you don't have to live in horrible student houses that are £185 a month with carbon monoxide poisoning and all kinds of horrific things.
Just speaking hypothetically, are we clear?
Yeah. We had a fireworks posted through our door. You know, now I'm at a point where, oh God, you know, I can actually live somewhere that is reasonably okay. But maybe some of that comes with timing. And as I said, that in my 20s, I really felt quite lost of, I don't know what I'm meant to be and who I'm meant to be and living my life, doing jobs and things that I thought I should do. And then suddenly, after perhaps a period of, I don't know, challenge, it's a bit like tasting honey. I think I kind of said it before about the sugar thing, where if you don't have sugar for 6 months and you get a little taste and how sweet that sugar is, and if things have really kind of make you look into quite a dark hole, that the smallest smile from a stranger can suddenly feel so rich and can really make your heart smile. And there's almost a sense that when you come through some of these challenges, that finding a place where you're comfortable and able to just be yourself ties in with the nature of feeling comfortable in where home might be.
And so much of what you've just talked about there is human connection and actually having a bunch of people that welcome you into this place wherever you've gone. I think that is just so key. You could be in a place of tremendous career opportunity, but if you don't have a bunch of people who, you know, Claire, come around on a Friday night, let's get together tomorrow afternoon. If you don't have that, then you're not going to feel at home. As much as it might be stimulating for your career and your professional prospects, this is where I'm grateful that we've been part of some really great churches and we have had a place wherever we've gone that we have something in common with a bunch of people, and they've got their weaknesses and these churches have got weaknesses as well. They have been the base for us to then just get connected with other people, just a starting point. Otherwise, where else would we go? yeah. Right. So, you know, there's only so much conversation you can have at a pub. You know, there's ways to do it. Obviously, colleagues at work is probably the biggest way that we build friendships. That's been a great gift to us. And so that was a really good thing. No matter where we went in the world, then we had a starting point there.
It's interesting because you know what mine was? Ukulele.
Yeah?
Yeah. When I lived on my own in Birmingham for a short period of time, there was often times where I don't really know how it ended up happening, but I would finish work on a Friday and I wouldn't talk to anyone until Monday, you know, and it was just endless box sets. And I happened to see an advert on a wall when I was walking down the street and it just said, Ukulele Club here on Thursdays. And I'd previously done loads of music and I took a bit of a punt really and messaged them on Twitter saying, look, I don't have a ukulele, but can I borrow one? Just have a little try. And, this was like 9 years ago now, and I walked through the door and they were really lovely. It was a bunch of people similar age. There were some other people living in bedsits and studios and one bedroom flats nearby who were also single and living alone. And then there wasn't any kind of seriousness. It was like, just have a couple of pints and play 80s songs really badly in the back room of a pub. And then, you know, I played with them for a few months really. And then when I moved to Manchester, again, a bit of a split decision, really. The first thing that I did was reach out to
the local ukulele club. Brilliant.
And I had my transit van still, so I moved in on the Saturday. On the Sunday, they'd had a rehearsal, so I drove in the transit van to the ukulele club. And some of the people who I met that night, one of the guys, I nicknamed him my Manchester dad, who I actually spent Christmas with 1 year. And one of my friends I went on holiday with, we're meeting up for lunch in a couple of days' time. And that was that sense of community made such a difference. And I'm in the process right now of buying my first home. And yeah, on the list was, where's the nearest ukulele
little
club?
Ukulele. That's it. Just one thing that builds you there. Connections with other people. And we have this in common. And the other thing probably that works in your situation was that the entry level requirements were quite low. You could play.
Are you saying that I was, if I'm shit, it's okay?
That, I'm basically saying that, yes. they welcomed you in. They welcomed you in even if you couldn't
play. Yeah, Claire, they welcomed you in.
That's right. Well, yeah, a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, but you know, isn't it funny how when your eyes are open, no matter how lost, how you are wandering through thinking, where is this going? That sometimes it can just be that poster, that little letter that's on a notice board in a supermarket, the smile from the person who's behind the checkout. And then that can just kind of take you down a whole different path that you never even thought was an option.
Yeah, the deep significance of little things is the way that I kind of say it now. We pass by so many of these tiny little things that you're saying. Come across this great story, you know, Marcel Marceau, you know, the classic mime artist. Well, somebody else you may not have heard of, Krzysztof Kieslowski. He's a film producer. He was. He's passed away now. And I read his books up on the shelf there. It's actually a big, long interview that was done with this, you know, classic master of European film about the way that he did his films. And he was telling the story about one day interviewing actors and actresses for one of his films, and this actress came in and they just got talking about the fact that when she felt really sad and really lonely, she would just walk out into the streets of Paris. And then she talked about this time where once she was so low, she was at the point of maybe thinking about taking her life, and she walked out into the streets of Paris, as was her custom, and she walked past Marcel Marceau. And she realized after she'd passed him, that was Marcel Marceau. And she stopped and she turned around and looked at him. And to her surprise, he stopped, turned around and looked at her and gave her a big smile lasting several seconds. And she said, that saved me that day. That smile saved me that day.
Wow.
Now, again, like you're just saying, you know, it's a poster on the wall, it's a smile or something. There's a deep significance to some of these small little things. And I think when you've gone through some stuff, when the dreams haven't worked out, then there is an opportunity for us to actually recognize some of these things are really deep, deep significance of little things.
What's next for you?
I feel like I'm in a good place. I feel like there's a lot more to do. The Making of Us has just come out, and so that's just a lot of fun because I get to do things like this. I just love, you know, some writers hate doing publicity and all that kind of stuff. I love talking. I love having these conversations, so I really like that. What we have seen happen with our story is it has kind of connected us with a tribe of people, not just people who haven't been able to have kids, although that's certainly one, but a whole bunch of other people for whom life just hasn't worked out as they planned, or it's just gone south or whatever. And that's been really quite precious. And I would like to serve that group as much as I can, however that comes, whether it's through radio stuff or more books or whatever. I was speaking at a place one night and telling our story, and it was a fairly large, it was a church actually, it was a very large church. And this guy came up to me afterwards and he said, I don't go to church. I've never been to this church. I was just walking past outside and just something drew me in. I just felt like I had to come into this place. And everything that you've talked about tonight, about broken dreams and needing to start again, he said, that's me. I've lost my marriage. I've lost my children. I've lost everything. And he said, tonight I was going to take my life. He said, I was going to get blind drunk. I was going to jump off that bridge just down the road there. It was in York. And he said, but now after what you've said and what I've heard, I'm not going to anymore. And you know what? That's what keeps me awake all day. I'll do that for as long as it takes to kind of reach those kinds of people.
You can find out more about what Sheridan's up to. He's got a website. I'll put the links to his stuff in our show notes.
And certainly if you're intrigued into more of his story about resilience and also about his own fertility story, he's got some great books that are definitely worth reading too. So do go find out those details. Next week, we get to meet an incredible guy called Matt.
They left me alone on the balcony with just enough gap so I could climb over the balcony edge. Exactly the same place that Naz had climbed over. I knew the slab that Naz had landed on. And I was so committed to it. In fact, I've never been so more committed to anything in my whole life. There was no option. That's what I was going to do. So as I clambered up, the silence broke into a voice. And I heard Naz's voice. And it said, "Matt, darling, I'm going to give you that reason to stay. I want you to set up a group or a foundation or something that's going to help other people." I turned the other way. I walked into the flat, sat on the floor, and just started crying my eyes out.
Matt is the final part of series 2 of the Fuck It Moments podcast. It's a heavy, hard listen, but also a story of so much hope, of someone who's finding a way through this muddy waters that so many of us right now are facing. Whatever your fuck it moment is right now, all I urge you to is just take that one small step, take that leap of faith if you need to, and hopefully you've been inspired by some of the stories that you're hearing as a part of this series.